Hello and welcome to an extraordinary edition of The Sound of Economics. I'm Nicholas Barrett. Sundar Pichai is the CEO of Alphabet and Google. Today he visited Brussels to talk to, among others, friend of the podcast Marguerite Vestager and Frans Timmermans, respectively the European Commissioners for Competition and the Environment. But not before sitting down with our very own Guntram Wolf to discuss his company's social responsibility, the future of artificial intelligence, and the morality of scale.
Hello and a very warm welcome from my side. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm absolutely delighted to host today this event on artificial intelligence featuring Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Alphabet and Google. It's a pleasure again to have you here and discuss with you today. Now, of course, AI is a great technology to help consumers find the things they want and they search for. Let's take YouTube, my YouTube feed, has really the kind of music I like the most. However, a recent study by Professor Allgaier actually shows that a lot of content on YouTube relating to climate change deviates from the scientific consensus and actually promotes views of climate deniers. I guess you can't censor those videos, but how do you use AI to prevent that these kind of videos get too much promoted?
You know, at Google, our core mission, first of all, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me, and it's a privilege. You know, our core mission, in fact, what we've set out to do as a company is to provide high quality, accurate, and trusted information. It's what we've been doing at Google for 20 years. And that same mission applies to YouTube as well. When we look at, we always get specific examples, but we analyze it as a system, right? Mm. And even in YouTube, we have worked hard to promote what we call as high-quality, authoritative content. And harmful content, when we measure, it's a very subset of less than 1% on our platforms. And in any area, we rank and we promote authoritative sources. And we use a recommendation engine to actually do so. So in some ways, we have an equal amount of opportunity to get the right views on climate promoted as part of our platforms. It's always important to balance free speech and making sure information presented is accurate. And it's a balance we are always working to get right. And AI increasingly helps us do that better as well. But it's work in progress for sure.
So you already mentioned that Google has published 7 principles on AI. Now, it's interesting, we can't go through all of these 7 principles, obviously, but it's interesting to see that the EU's independent expert group on artificial intelligence also came up with 7 principles on AI. Those principles quite overlap with those of Google, but there's some difference. And one difference I spotted is that the EU experts want human agency and oversight over AI, which you do not mention in your 7 principles. So perhaps you can explain to us, if there is no oversight, how does it work that Google's AI is actually socially beneficial, which is your goal, free of bias and accountable?
You know, first of all, I think it's important to appreciate the reason there's a lot of overlap in these principles is because they're rooted in fundamental core human values.
Of course.
And I think we share all of this as humanity, and so I think it's great to see the commonality. You know, accountability is an important part of our AI principles. We want our systems to be accountable and explainable and be tested for safety. And I think inevitably doing that, we assume, will involve, human agency and, humans to review. And we specifically mentioned that we want these systems to be accountable to people.
And so, Google employees?
To society at large. And I think regulation should play a role in that as well. Like today, for example, you have GDPR, which ensures accountability on privacy, which is an important right. And I think the same thing should apply to AI as well. So we assume to do that correctly, you need humans to review it, but humans alone won't be enough. It's got to be, you need AI systems to be able to review AI systems as well. So I think it's both are important. But I don't view this as a substantial difference. And
Well, I'm still, just to push you a bit on that point, I think the interesting question is always who in the end takes these decisions. And I think you're right, the AI needs to inform you and needs to you can't do it yourself because there's just too many videos out there on YouTube and so on. But so you need humans at some level. But who decides on who are these humans and who takes the responsibility, really? I mean, should it be independent working groups of independent experts? How do you see that for Google being organized, really?
You know, within Google, the way we do it today is we have AI Technology Review Council. It's internally to Google, but we have working groups in each teams which are building products, and we have a higher level review group which reviews sensitive projects for approval. That's how we do it within Google. But I think how do you scale it up outside and develop frameworks, I think, is going to be an important part of the conversation. But I think once there's regulation, there are regulatory bodies which will have oversight, and I think that serves as a good framework for how to approach these things. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a bit about geopolitics. You already mentioned that you think AI needs to be regulated. Of course, in the transatlantic view, and you started off by saying we can work together on the transatlantic, but in the transatlantic relation, there's different views on how strongly artificial intelligence should be regulated. Some think the US especially thinks a light touch regulation is probably fine, while in Europe, I guess the tendency is probably we should go for a bit stronger and tougher regulation. And I guess my question is, do you think we got it right with the high data protection standards that the EU has? Should it even go further? And when it comes to industrial data, which is the new front, I mean, the consumer data, Google has it already, but the industrial data, the relevant European Commissioner Thierry Breton, he just published an op-ed, I think, a week ago or so, suggesting that we should make sure that these kind of data remain really in Europe and should be protected as a European, core European asset. How do you see the dealing with data and the transatlantic divide?
You know, again, even in to start with AI regulation, US launched what I would say is a set of AI principles, and the good news is again, they share a lot of commonality. I think the US approach has given more weight to a sector-based approach and less in a cross-cutting way, a set of AI principles, plus a focus on specific sectors driving regulation. I think it's okay for, I see a lot of alignment. The pace may be different. That's happened in privacy. It's been great to see Europe bring a single privacy framework. I remember the days, dealing with, 26 different privacy regulations, I think actually makes it very, very hard to have a common framework like GDPR. I think actually gives certainty to people, helps businesses approach. If you're an European entrepreneur building a company in Europe, now you can more easily scale across all of Europe, which is an important advantage if you can do that. And so I think those have been good developments. And GDPR can serve as a template to other places around the world. And so I think it's been okay to see that. I think in AI, with the new European Commission, there's been a clear focus on AI regulation. We see it as an opportunity to drive some important conversations, while remembering the technology is in very early days. Mm. So some things which we would consider today as being very concerning will evolve sharply. So there's a balance to be had. It's important as we look at AI regulation, for Europe, AI also presents a huge opportunity. Europe has a very strong industrial economy. And to continue to be at the forefront of the economy, AI is going to play a role. Mm. And so the ability of European industry to adopt and adapt AI for its needs is going to be very critical for the continent's future. And so it's important to keep that in mind, and that's where the balance has to come from.
And so when it comes to the data ownership question, I mean, there's also a question on Slido by David Postius. What principles should apply, in your opinion, to any legislation that deals with data ownership and data sharing? I mean, this is a particularly relevant question, and especially when it comes to industrial data. I mean, so the firms want to adopt AI, they want to adopt it, but that AI at the moment is basically American or Chinese. So should we find our own AI, or should we make sure that the data gets protected here? How do we deal with the data ownership?
When we do cloud partnerships, the data is owned by the customer. In all those cases, it's encrypted and the customer has the key. So first of all, so when we deal with industrial data, the companies hold the data, right? And that's important to understand that. And as part of it, as Europe develops its industrial data policy, I think we are happy to, I think it makes sense to support that, and just like we've done it on the consumer side. But it's important to give people certainty and comfort and choice and transparency around how their data is dealt with. Just like we've done on the consumer side, it's equally important for industries as well. But from a Google Cloud standpoint, we assume and we operate according to the principles of the customer holds their own data, and it's protected by their own key, and we encrypt it on our side.
Let's talk a bit about the social consequences of artificial intelligence. Many, of course, fear that AI will take your job, my job, perhaps many jobs, and feel that social consequences of artificial intelligence could be quite dramatic. Do you agree with such worry? What would be your strategy to mitigate the consequences of AI on job polarization, on social consequences?
It's a great question. I think the right approach is to be concerned, given the potential for AI. It's important to look back in history. We as a society have adapted through significant moments of technological change. As Google, we recently completed a study with McKinsey, which looked at the impact of automation in the European regional market. And if you look at the European regional jobs market, by 2020, there are more jobs that have been created than lost due to automation. So I think that serves as a guideline. With every new technology, there are newer things that get created as well. And that'll be true for AI as well. But even in a scenario where there are newer types of jobs created, it's nevertheless going to be disruptive. People will have to shift to entirely new jobs. And that's hard. And which is why I think the more urgent thing is to think about reskilling. How do you take your workforce and the ability to teach them new skills at different points in their careers? So digital reskilling is very, very important. I think one of the most important things for governments to involve in. It happens to be a big effort which Google is part of. So far in Europe alone, we have trained over 5 million Europeans on digital skills training. And over 100,000 Belgians here. But it's an ongoing work on our part. But I think that is important to do as we deal with AI. It is going to be a challenge, but it also presents opportunities. And we have to, the only way out of it is to invest in our ability to reskill large portions of your workforce on a continual basis. I think gone are those days when you can study once and then work for the rest of your life. I think that will change in the future. And so our ability as a society to adapt to that is going to be really important.
Let's talk a moment about sustainability. Of course, AI can play a role in achieving sustainability. And I got a question from a person called Axel. 18 people like that question. Between engineers, some people talk about power sustainability and others will make it happen. Could Google AI help crack the code of fusion power? Very specific question, but perhaps you answer the question sustainability more generally.
As I said in my speech too, I think AI, the area which it has such huge potential on an immediate nature is climate change. We see it in our work. We run our data centers much more efficiently than others, and we do it using AI, at least for part of the solution. And through Google Cloud, we are making it available. We are helping improve weather forecasting, better predictions. In the case of wind energy, for example, we are able to better model and predict wind patterns, and hence you can make improvements to how you run your grid when you offload. That drives about 20% efficiency on our wind projects. So across the board, we see AI playing a big role in sustainability. Google has been carbon neutral since 2007. And increasingly we will rely on AI, not only to do it within our company, but to help other companies do it. Now, to go to your question around nuclear fusion, we actually have a project where we are working on using AI to help improve nuclear fusion. And you know, it's a classic case where when you look at a typical nuclear fusion setup, the number of variables you're dealing with is really, really a large number for humans to model it alone. So we are using AI to help improve modeling of the environment there. And you know, I'm optimistic those are all areas where we can drive improvements. And so, yes, it's something we are working on.
Exciting. Well, you have been appointed to be the CEO of Alphabet in addition to Google quite recently. Perhaps you can talk to us about how this is different and how you think EU policymakers should see such a large and very powerful company. I mean, your market capitalization has just exceeded 1 trillion, if I read the news correctly, so congratulations. But it's a very big, big company. And I think Mr. Anonymous asked the question, is big bad?
It's a natural question which comes with scale. I think there are clear advantages of being able to take a long-term view and invest in scale. You know, we've been working on quantum computing as a company for 13 years, and in 2019 we achieved an important milestone called quantum supremacy. You know, when we make these advances, we publish, we share our research, we contribute it back to the outside world as open source as well. So being a large company allows us to invest in technology for the long run, and we can take a long-term view. And so I see this, importance of things like that. But with that scale should come scrutiny. I think that's the right approach. We want to use our scale to do things which will take a long time and are very difficult to do. We've been working on self-driving technology for 10 years now. And regardless of how many years it takes us to get there, we see the societal benefit of saving lives. So those are the kinds of projects we can do by being big. But I think it's important that, you know, we state our goals clearly. We are more transparent as a company at our scale. And, you know, we engage constructively when we need to. And we form public-private partnerships, including with governments around the world, to do our work better. But, you know, just like EU is an institution which comes together to work at scale, I think there are times when scale gives you the opportunity to do more important things than you can do as a smaller company as well.
Still, many worry. Of course, in the US, there's a very active debate. Senator Elizabeth Warren has argued that big tech should be broken apart because they're just too big. So how strong really is your case that the size advantage really outweighs the possible risks for consumers, for society, the concentration of power? How strong is that argument, really?
It's up to society to decide how big companies should be, right? It's not for any individual company to decide, you know, and it's important to be fact-based. You know, all indications that consumers are really benefiting, from the work we are doing across many, many areas. But I think it's an important debate to continue to have. And, you know, it's not the first time there's been debate when companies have gotten large.
Of course.
But if you look at 10 years ago, you mentioned market capitalization, and you look at the largest market capitalized companies 10 years ago, they are not the highest market cap companies 10 years since then. Technology changes fast, so I think it's a very dynamic world as well.
So we will host tomorrow Executive Vice President Margrethe Vestager. I think you will meet her this afternoon. What would be your message to her on how Europe should regulate artificial intelligence?
You know, I'm excited at the new European Commission and the leadership. I'm looking forward to meeting both EVP Vestager and EVP Timmermans later today. Specifically, you know, I think it's exciting that the Commission has taken a clear focus on both AI and sustainability, two important areas, I think. On AI regulation, my message would be that it's an important area to be regulated. It's too critical not to do it. But I think it's important to, we are in early days, it's important to build based on existing regulations, leverage it where we can, and choose applications and think through the impact on certain applications, the higher risk applications, and start with regulation there first. And in industries like healthcare, where there is existing regulation, again, take advantage of it.
So case-by-case regulation, really, or
principles, no case-by-case regulation, also setting up better public-private partnerships. I think for this to work well, no different from climate change, all of us have to do it together. AI is something which is going to work at a global scale. There are many countries involved. I think go it alone won't work for anyone. And so the more we can bring private sector and governments together and drive international frameworks, I think that will be a great way to do it for the long run.
Perhaps my very last question, I'm afraid we don't have time for more, is about China. China has its own approach to the internet, its own approach to data regulation, its own approach to privacy. How does that affect a company like Google, and how does it affect also the European Union? What would you advise also the European Union how it should deal with China and Chinese technology?
You know, for me, when I look at AI, and you know, I talked about the importance of a global framework. Just like climate, it's happening. You know, China is a participatory in Paris Agreement and so on. As we think through AI technology over time, a lot of AI technology is going to be developed in China. And so I think the more we can drive common frameworks over time, is going to be an important basis for it. Maybe over time, multilateral trade frameworks can also include technology under it, and that serves as a basis to do that. I've been heartened by the fact that OECD and G20 are increasingly talking about, you know, things like AI as part of the work they are setting out to do. That gives another way by which we can engage with China on these topics as well.
Since we have 50 seconds left, let me ask you one more question, which is by Javier Espinosa from the Financial Times. And it is about the U.S. mulling proposals on a moratorium on facial recognition technologies, and the UK is considering similar plans. Do you agree with a temporary ban of facial recognition?
What I think is more important, you know, Google, for now, because we realized facial recognition is fraught with risks, we don't today offer it as a general purpose API. You know, we have held off on doing that. So we understand the risks associated with it. So I think it's important that governmental regulation tackles it sooner rather than later and gives a framework for it. Whether, you know, what form it takes is too early to tell, but I think it's important governments are involved giving the path.
But not immediately.
It can be immediate. You know, maybe there's a waiting period before we really think about how it's used. But there are positive use cases as well. So I think it's up to governments to charter the course, and it can be done in partnership. But I do think it's an important area, and it has to be one of the higher risk applications which we tackle in the first wave of use cases we see.
Well, thank you very much, Sundar, for your time today and for this interview. It was a pleasure to host you today, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we're back at Google HQ after our event. Guntram Wolf is with me, and Maria de Mertzis is here too. Guntram, what were your impressions?
Well, I first of all, I like to be outside of HQ, so this was it was nice to be at this venue and have a great crowd actually listening. I think there were a lot of very, very interested citizens and policymakers from across Europe, and I think they really all looked at this speech also because the topic is really such an important topic, and people are really concerned about the impact of artificial intelligence on their daily lives, on their jobs, and on everything. And of course, Sundar Pichai gave his pitch, which is the pitch also published today in the Financial Times. But I think overall, it's clear that difficult issues, it's very difficult also for a CEO of a $1 trillion company to answer them in public. So he made a strong statement by saying, we need to regulate AI. But when I pushed him a bit on, well, how do you do this? How to hold the users of AI accountable, how to make sure that there's human oversight, and, you know, really to not just have Google employees, but, you know, independent voices looking into what is making sure that AI is human-centered and beneficial to society. His answers were, let's say, quite general. And I think that's in a sense, it's understandable. But I think, of course, as we go forward, we will have to find more concrete and practical answers on these issues, which involve civil society, which involve democratically elected voters, because AI as a general purpose technology is just too important to leave it unregulated and to leave it only in the hands of big companies.
Maria, you were in the front row today. Why do you think Google are keen to tell a Brussels audience that they are in favor of more regulation?
Well, I mean, I think one thing that came out of the presentation today, and first of all, let me say how delighted we were to host such an important player in this sector. He was important, and I think he was successful in conveying that sense of responsibility that comes with being such a big player in a very new environment, digital environment. Now, I mean, you know, the responsibility, of course, one could argue, does it go far enough? I mean, are you convinced in the 20 minutes that you've listened to him that they are indeed responsible? I mean, I think they are big innovators and the society needs innovation. So I think that's a good thing. But at the same time, it's important to identify where and who should take what responsibility. I mean, we have to remember this is still a private firm. It is a for-profit firm. It has got an incentive behind it to generate value added that will be distributed to the shareholders. I mean, that is the business model, right? But they are so important in sort of developing the technology ahead that, you know, we need to listen to them. He sounded very open to the responsibilities that he and his colleagues need to take as a result of technology diffusion. I know how sincere that was. I mean, it remains to be seen. I mean, he seemed keen to also talk about societal issues. I was quite impressed by the answer to Guntram's question, you know, big necessarily bad? I mean, he said, you know, it is the society that decides how big a firm should be. I think that's a crucial point. And, you know, it made me think as to whether a Google could ever be developed in a society, some European countries, which are actually not as open to these big firms. But I think that was an important message.
Of course, Google and Europe, the European Union, have had a bit of a rocky relationship in recent years. Straight after this event, he went off to see Margrethe Vestager, the commissioner responsible for competition and artificial intelligence, and Frans Timmermans, who's responsible for sustainability and the European Green Deal. What kind of questions do you think should people in the European Commission and perhaps the European Parliament be asking themselves about the relationship they want to have with Google and Silicon Valley?
Well, I certainly think the issue of data is going to be the big thing. I mean, the European Union has been a bit of a sort of an innovator when it comes to regulating the data circulation, and he even acknowledged that today in our meeting. So there, I think Europe is taking a first step into this. Now, how far it can go and at what cost is, of course, something that needs to still be investigated. But I think big firms, including Google, will seem quite keen to think together with regulators on this issue. They've got the right incentives to do that. But I think they also want to show part of that responsibility that I said earlier on, that, you know, they have data, and as they told us today, the consumers are always the owners of data. But, you know, persuading the society that this is so requires an extra step. And I think this is part of the effort.
Well, perhaps the one point I would add, I think European companies suffer from actually a dilemma. On the one hand, they need to introduce artificial intelligence as quickly as possible, because without these technologies, you lose the competitive edge in global markets. And European firms are, of course, very active in global markets. On the other hand, a lot of that technology is not being provided by European companies. It's being provided by either American or Chinese companies. And so the worry is that as you let foreign companies' technology into your own firms, let these companies actually gather your data, those companies will get ever better in using these data and improving their algorithms and their machine learning behind it. And Europe will again lose the race for the next frontier, which is, of course, not consumers, but it's companies and industrial data. And so I think from a European point of view, what I think Margrethe Vestager and Thierry Breton, the two relevant commissioners, need to really think about is, How do you deal with the fact that we have so few top European firms in the space of artificial intelligence, machine learning? I think the key priority, if you ask me, for them is really trying to improve the ecosystem that these kinds of firms can grow and improve. And then on top of that, the key question, as Maria rightly says, is data. Can we keep a certain degree of autonomy on the data? Can we make sure that the data are perhaps publicly available in anonymized way so that machine learning applications of different European companies can actually learn jointly on these kind of data? But I think it's very important to think about the two. I mean, your ecosystem, we need these kind of firms ourselves, which we don't have and which is going to be increasingly become a problem. And, well, what about the data and making sure that data are to the benefit of wider society?
It's often said that the European Union has a good single market for goods, but a not so good single market for services, which means if you're developing a service and a digital service, you have to adapt what you're selling to 28 different markets. Whereas if you do so in America, you can instantly expand your product across the United States, which gives American firms a huge advantage over any European competitors that might emerge. But could it already be too late for this? Because these companies that have huge amounts of data, they benefit so much from these economies of scale that it becomes a winner-takes-all thing. Even like Elizabeth Warren now is proposing to break up Google. And even in this world, if you had YouTube, Google, and Gmail as all separate companies, they would still all be by far the best at what they do. And it's hard to imagine anybody competing with either of them anyway. So how can Europeans compete?
Well, I mean, I think the first point to make is that I think it's an important message that the size of the market is important and matters, and it's much less competition policy enforcement. I mean, these big companies in the US, they aren't as big because of competition policy, which seemed to be a tendency on the European side to think, well, if only we changed our antitrust policy, then we would have these big companies. No, we need to create the single market. And I think there's no shortcut around this. And that's heavy work. And in services, it's actually very difficult because there's so much, well, country-specific idiosyncrasies. Some countries wanting to protect that, others different things. So this is big work, and I don't think you can shortcut that. So it's very important to work on that. Now then, I think on your question of the firms and the firm size, I mean, there is indeed a question of regulation and the size of these firms. As you say, it's not only about breaking up, it's also about the kind of data that they already have and to what extent this data needs to become more public. I think that's or more accessible. I think that's one big debate. But then I would say, in addition, I would certainly emphasize that the technological race is not yet lost. I mean, it's perhaps lost in the consumer market. But the industrial policy and, I mean, the industrial sector is huge. And now we are at the beginning of what is called Internet of Things. I mean, that's actually happening. And the Internet of Things is really about data that is not consumer data, but really data of machines talking to each other. And it's a massive amount of data. And in that space, there is actually quite a bit of developments also in Europe. I mean, so there's European top firms that really have the kind of AI technology also and are really at the frontier in that kind of an AI technology. So I think there it's really about getting the framework right that these firms can develop and that they can partner with the right technology firms to really boost the capacity. So I don't think the race in the industrial policy sector, in the industrial sector, is lost.
Mm. And Maria, he was also, Sundra Pichai, he was also going to meet Frans Timmermans to talk about sustainability. What kind of role could Google play in environmental policies?
Well, I mean, I think if you believe that the climate issue is a an urgency. Like I do, everybody has a role to play, and it's not just sufficient to talk about how green Google is. I mean, as we hear today, they have been sort of the footprint has been neutral since 2007. I think
that's what he said. Yeah.
That's what he said today in the meeting. I mean, that of course is a good example to give, but I think investments in sustainability come in all sorts from all the research that you can sponsor, which I think it's crucial from batteries, from better energy transition. There, they can play a role from their own research. I mean, they are having the autonomous vehicle. I mean, if this is the model of the future, what kind of vehicle are we talking about here? I think big companies like this have a big role to play in terms of promoting the transition, because that's the difficult part, transiting into an economy that is, into a society, not just an economy, that is much more aware of the footprint that it leaves behind. Google, by being a leader in the digital economy, also has a role to play there.
Great. Thank you, Maria. Thank you, Guntram. For more podcasts like this, subscribe to The Sound of Economics, and for literature on all the subjects we've discussed and much, much more, visit google.org. Thank you for listening.